This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, a group of fed-up parents in Southern California moved to shut down their local public elementary school. A new so-called parent trigger law in the state says that if a majority of a school's parents sign a petition, they can force changes in failing schools. Chrissy Clark of member station KQED has this report.
Ismania Guzman walked up to the office of the Compton Unified School District holding a thick binder. Inside were 269 signatures of parents demanding a charter school company take over McKinley Elementary. Guzman's hands shook as she handed the binder over.
And this is our petitions of us parents that really care for our kids' education.
Yeah, well, we all care for our kids' education.
And with that pointed response, the school district's Karen Friesen took the petition. It was a brief exchange, but one that pushes school reform into unknown, divisive territory. Connecticut has its own trigger law, and six other states are considering a similar measure. These parents in Compton are the first to invoke the law. As they celebrated their historic step, Guzman explained she's afraid her daughter's getting a shoddy education at McKinley. It ranks in the lowest 10% of California schools, in a district where less than half the students graduate from high school.
They don't challenge the kids to go any further than what they have to. Like charter schools, they challenge the kids the most.
Also at the rally was Shamika Murphy. She has a daughter who just graduated from McKinley with high marks, only to get C's and D's in middle school. And Murphy says her second grader is way behind in reading.
I think that this would be something to help. Something has to be better.
McKinley parents say they never would have known they could demand a charter school takeover if it weren't for a guy named Ben Austin.
The only way we're going to change things is for parents to take back power over the education of their own kids.
Austin doesn't live in Compton, but he runs a nonprofit called Parent Revolution that's been organizing here. It's a spinoff from Green Dot, a national charter school company. Austin's group lobbied for the parent trigger law that went into effect earlier this year. Then his paid staff went door to door looking for fed up parents ready to sign the petition.
The first time they came to me, they said it was to improve the school, so I signed the petition.
Carla Garcia was trying to get her name off the petition before parents loaded onto a bus to deliver it to the school district. She said she thought her signature was for upgrades like new grass by the playground.
But then I find out it was for a charter school, which I didn't like it. And I'm more confused now, so I don't know what to do.
Organizers at Parent Revolution say they made it clear what the petition was for, and they claim school staff have been using scare tactics on parents who signed. Confusion over the petition was still echoing at a PTA meeting a few days later in McKinley.
The only thing I want is that you guys really know what you signed, okay?
At the back of the room, some parents signed a new petition to recant the first. By the end of the night, it had more than 50 names, nearly enough to unpull the trigger on the parent trigger law. After the meeting, McKinley's principal, Fleming Robinson, looked exhausted.
We all as a community want our school to be great, and that's why we were brought to this point. But as an educational leader, I believe it's my goal to achieve that, and I think we can achieve it here at McKinley.
In fact, during Fleming's leadership of the last 2 years, test scores have actually made steady, significant gains, but not fast enough for those who want to turn the school over to a charter company. It's hard to wait for a school to get better while your child falls behind. The real question, though, might not be when to pull the trigger, but figuring out where to aim. For NPR News, I'm Chrissy Clark.
Elizabeth Edwards lost a son, lost her marriage, got sick, and got scalded in the bright-hot light of fame. But anyone who's a parent will understand, after the death of a child, all other hurt seems small. In 1996, strong winds overturned young Wade Edwards' Jeep on a North Carolina highway. He died at the age of 16. Nothing overturns your faith in God, fairness, goodness, or makes you ask why you should go on living more than the death of a child. I had to reconcile the God I thought I had with the facts I knew, Elizabeth Edwards said in recent months. I couldn't pray any more for God to intervene, which means I can't pray for him to intervene in my cancer. Instead, the God that I came to accept promises salvation and enlightenment, and that's the God I live with now. It's not entirely the God I want, but it is the God I believe I have. When her cancer returned in 2007, Elizabeth Edwards continued with her husband's campaign for president. She said she couldn't let sickness thwart her work for what she thought was right, including health care overhaul. She already knew death. Wade's loss made her want to pack meaning and striving into whatever life she had left. She may have been hurt by her husband's hound dog ways, or those quickie campaign histories that tried to puncture her image with things she might have said when she was anxious and pained, but her heart had been wrung out already. Elizabeth Edwards shared a mutual admiration with Tony Snow, the conservative columnist who was President George W. Bush's press secretary and had colon cancer. When he died in 2008, Elizabeth Edwards said that, "Although we came to nearly every argument from opposite corners of the ring, we each chose to reach for something larger than the life and body with which we were saddled." For millions of Americans whose families live with cancer, Elizabeth Edwards demonstrated that people who bear disease still have life to cherish and give others, and maybe an extra jolt of fire and wisdom, too. When people ask author Christopher Hitchens, who has esophageal cancer, how he is these days, he says, "I'm dying, so are you. The process has just accelerated on me." And so as Mr. Hitchens continues to write, speak, inspire, and enrage, Elizabeth Edwards continued to speak out, embrace her family, and offer others the comfort of her courage and good sense. It's apt to use a basketball term to remember someone who made her life in North Carolina. Elizabeth Edwards played the clock until the very last second. She was a ray of life. You're listening to NPR News.
The image is iconic. The stubby barrel, the inverted arc of the banana clip. Bin Laden put one in his post-9/11 video. Saddam had a pair with him upon capture. It appears on the flags of Mozambique and Hezbollah. The Kalashnikov rifle, or AK-47, can be found in every major conflict of the past 50 years. C.J. Chivers, a Pulitzer Prize winner for The New York Times, has written a book tracing the history of this lethal firearm, and he joins me on the line from Zahri in southern Afghanistan, where he's reporting for The Times. Chris Chivers, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Chris, it's actually pretty fitting that we've reached you in Afghanistan because the Kalashnikov has played such a large role in the fighting there over the years.
Yeah, the Kalashnikov is certainly one of the principal instruments of the insurgents here, and it's been in circulation in the country for several decades, to the point of which it's one of the most common sights out in the Afghan countryside.
What is it about this weapon that's changed the nature of warfare over the past 50 years?
There's two things. The first is the weapon is quite easy to use. It's not especially powerful. It doesn't have a lot of recoil. It's very easy to assemble and disassemble. It doesn't jam. So once this weapon got into the hands of insurgents and guerrillas and the like, it made them more effective than they've ever been. It let them, for the first time really in history, fight the most powerful nations on the earth and fight them, you know, effectively in rifle fights, fight them to a standstill even. Now, the second thing that makes it what it has become has been its sheer numbers. This was produced by the tens of millions, often by countries that eventually lost custody of them. And so one of the reasons it's so popular today is because it's so available.
Now, this the AK-47 was developed after World War II. Why were people looking for this kind of weapon?
Well, the Soviet Union had faced Germany on its western flank during the Great Patriotic War, and the Germans had fielded an assault rifle, a weapon that was sort of midway in power between pistols and the traditional rifles of the time, and could be fired automatically. And the Soviet Union, having faced this, in the hands of its adversaries, realized it was a breakthrough, and they wanted to copy it.
You also write that in the U.S., defense leaders didn't seem to take this idea seriously or take this weapon very seriously. Where was the focus of the U.S. then, and why not on this particular style of weapon?
The United States took its rifle program very seriously, but that's the key way to understand this. the word rifle. They didn't think when the Kalashnikov came along that it was even a rifle. They classified it as a submachine gun. They thought that it was too small and not powerful enough to be a rifle. And so sort of by definition, they didn't consider it to be worthy of their own soldiers. And they were invested in a larger, heavier rifle that fired a more powerful round. And this was something they took very seriously, but it turned out would not be as well suited for the war that was coming in Vietnam.
Can the AK-47, can it be blamed for making certain conflicts last longer, making certain conflicts bloodier? Can this particular weapon be blamed for making things worse, for better or worse, when it comes to war?
Well, I would say that the weapon has two qualities that certainly make things worse. One is the durability of the weapon. It lasts a long time. I routinely find them here in Afghanistan from the 1950s. These weapons are six decades old. They're still working quite well. We don't know how long a Kalashnikov takes to die. And so once a country gets armed up with Kalashnikovs, it's very, very hard for that country to disarm. Now, the other quality is the sheer numbers of these weapons. They're so readily available in many conflict zones. And so I would say that these two things, the durability of the weapon and this, you know, this outsized production and availability of the weapon, certainly have made some wars much harder to fight.
And lastly, Chris, is there anything that can be done then about the proliferation of Kalashnikovs?
I would say that you shouldn't put me in the hopeful box there. The weapons that are out in the field are very, very hard to collect. Now, longer term, I think that you can affect future supply by securing and destroying some of the weapons in the Eastern European and Russian and Chinese stockpiles. The rifles that are already out, they're out to stay. They have to be collected literally one at a time. And there's not much more that I can think of that's more costly than that.
C.J. Chivers is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. His new book is The Gun. Chris Chivers, thank you for joining me, and be careful out there.
Thanks, audience. I really appreciate it.
Talk about stress. Your popularity ratings are dipping, pundits pound you from the left and right. You get shellacked in midterm elections. The unemployment rate stalls near 10%. Then one day a friend elbows you in the chops under the basket. You need so many stitches you can't even pronounce superfluous. Is this really the best time to try to give up smoking? But this week, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said he hadn't seen President Obama smoking in probably 9 months. And just in time. This week, a new Surgeon General's report detailed the damage of inhaling even the smoke from one cigarette. Surgeon General Regina Benjamin says inhaling even the smallest amount of tobacco smoke can damage your DNA, which can lead to cancer. So the next time the president hears of some harangue from the floor of the Congress, he might want to reach for a stick of gum. Sugarless.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death,
tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hate to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
And you're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Climate talks in Cancun, Mexico, ended early this morning with a modest agreement that keeps the teetering United Nations process alive. It seemed at some points during the two-week negotiations that this international effort would simply collapse. Instead, delegates managed to achieve a few successes, but scientists say not nearly enough. NPR's Richard Harris joins us in our studios. Richard, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
And first, what did the delegates deliver in Cancun?
Well, the good news first. I guess there was a deal on forestry, and this provides a mechanism to reward countries if they preserve, particularly tropical forests. Let's remember that forests soak up carbon dioxide, and in fact, cutting them down contributes to about 20% of carbon emissions. So if you can figure out ways to slow deforestation or even regrow forests, that's good. That's a very good measure for global warming. Also, the delegates agreed to a new fund to help the poor nations of the world adapt to a changing climate and also to develop using cleaner energy sources. Now, that fund is supposed to ramp up to about $100 billion a year by the year 2020. And even though they figured out how to structure the fund, they did not figure out where the money was going to come from. They've been talking about maybe taxing jet fuel or fuel for ships, but that did not come out of these talks.
How far did they get on efforts to slow emissions of carbon dioxide and other gases that build up in the atmosphere.
Well, not very far at all. Optimists would say, though, that the progress here was simply preventing the whole enterprise from falling apart altogether. Let me take you back to Kyoto in 1997. And at that meeting, nations agreed to legally binding measures that would start to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But you may recall the U.S. never signed up to that. And mm-hmm. other big emitters like China actually didn't have any obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. So it was finally at this meeting in Cancun, both Japan and Russia said, look, if that's the best that Kyoto is going to offer, we don't want to participate anymore. We don't want to cut our emissions based under the Kyoto Protocol anymore. That, however, was very upsetting to some people in the developing world because that's the only thing that's really binding obligations that are out there. And there was a feeling that if that rift wasn't resolved in Cancun, the whole talks could have actually just crumbled up. But what happened was they agreed to essentially kick that disagreement down the road.
Well, and that brings up the huge expectations that were built up last year when world leaders, including President Obama, gathered in Copenhagen for these talks. And so little came of it. How did that affect this year's meetings in Cancun?
Well, I think one thing was expectations were a whole lot lower for these meetings. And I talked this morning to Elliot Duringer, who is from the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. He's actually at the talks in Cancun. And he says that in his view, the talks took on a much more realistic tone.
For too long, the almost exclusive focus in this process has been getting binding commitments. It's almost been binding or nothing. And as a result, we've gotten nothing for a long time. And this time, they were ready to go forward with some incremental steps that aren't going to solve the problem, but are at least going to move us forward.
Duringer said that maybe someday the world will return to this idea that everyone makes actual pledges that they keep in terms of reducing emissions. But that's out of reach right now, he says, and at least they're doing something.
Let me raise a question, Richard, which I come to think of it, we've raised in a number of realms. So what do UN talks do? What do they accomplish?
Well, at least in this case, what the talks are doing is they're establishing an agreement that something needs to be done. Not necessarily ways to accomplish it, but there is sort of a global agreement now that the world should not heat up more than 2 degrees centigrade. That's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And when you're thinking of a global average, that's actually a lot more heating than that's really actually very substantial heating. So they've agreed at least to that principle. That what they haven't figured out how to do is how to essentially get everyone on the same page to figure out how to do it. It's really hard because basically what you're talking about is phasing out fossil fuels between now and 2050, by and large. And there's sort of the metabolism of the global economy. It's an enormous challenge. And getting people at least to say, yeah, we ought to do it is a step in the right direction. And the fact that they haven't figured out how they're going to do it, well, I guess we understand that.
NPR's Richard Harris, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tis the season for the Nutcracker. No matter where you are, there's likely a version being performed on stage or bellowing from a radio nearby. One production in San Francisco is decorated with a grab bag of political causes. April Domboski reports on the revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie.
At the Dance Mission Studios in San Francisco, young girls learn a civics lesson along with their pliés.
I'm Frederica Kiefer, and I play Sugar Plum.
My name is Stella Edelman. I get to play the Mouse King.
I'm Madison Parker. I'm a narrator. I'm in Waltz of the Flowers, and I'm also playing Paris Hilton.
Chrissy Kiefer is the writer and director of the revolutionary Nutcracker Sweetie.
We are a political dance company in that we try to make work that is socially relevant, that is responding to the real ideas and real needs of people today in the community.
It all starts on the night of the big party at the home of the richest family in town, the Magrides. Guests mingle around the red velvet couch and chair. 4 Swan Lake ballerinas arrive in tutus, then aerobics teachers in workout gear, and ninjas from The Matrix. There's a narrator who stands under chilly twinkle lights reciting the guest list.
Landlord, lawyers, wealthy old prunes, a bevy of brokers, a tribe of tycoons, movie stars, baseball stars, flash with cash. I hear even Paris Hilton was trying to crash.
In this Nutcracker, there is no dutiful daughter Clara waiting for a Christmas gift from her Uncle Drosselmeyer. There are 3 Claras. They are Latina immigrants working in the house of Mr. and Mrs. Magreed.
The first scene we see are the 3 Claras getting ready for the party. Mrs. Magreed comes in and she wants their attention right away. And
Clara! Clara, can you put some ice in my drink? Thank you, precious.
Clara, can you get me some aspirin? I just have a terrible headache.
And then Drosselmeyer comes home, and he's the McGreed's oldest son.
Their gay son, in a Che Guevara t-shirt and a pink mohawk.
And he travels all over the world, and he brings all these dolls from all over the world. And he gives one of the dolls to Clara, and it's a freedom fighter. And that freedom fighter turns into a real person and takes Clara on a journey of self-discovery. And a one, two, three, four.
At rehearsals leading up to the show, Kiefer directs the performers through each dance of Clara's journey.
Chasse, attitude, around, pull up.
There's a snow dance where ice caps melt in the background.
Tonnelier, Tonnelier.
The Sugar Plum Fairy battles the Mouse King of British Petroleum.
Da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
And Code Pink makes a guest appearance in the triumphant anti-war dance. The politically themed Nutcracker is a kind of revolution for dancers, too. They get to sneak in a few hip-hop and salsa steps with their Tchaikovsky. For NPR News, I'm April Dembosky.